Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, November 22nd, 2019. I was hoping with the closing of these impeachment investigation hearings, the lead-in to next week's Thanksgiving holiday, that this would be a slow news day and I could catch up a little bit. But once again, just like Monday, I've got a news glut and I'm going to do my best to plow through it all. So today, Trump went on the counterattack, attacking Adam Schiff, the chair of the impeachment inquiry at the Intelligence Committee in the House, and calling one witness a liar. Now, I haven't been able to see this. I've just read news accounts, but Trump called into his buddies at Foxy Friends, and they sat there looking at the camera while he blabbed on for a reported 53 minutes. So I only have the lowlights here. And one of his comments is that Adam Schiff is a sick puppy, a corrupt politician, and the first witness he would want to call in a Senate impeachment trial. But get this. At one point, he told his friends on Fox and Friends, when asked if he'll be impeached, "I don't expect it. I think it's very hard for them to impeach you when they have absolutely nothing." But at some other point in this phone-in, and by the way, you know, TV channels don't like to have guests on the phone. It doesn't work very well, right? Because the viewers are looking at just the blank faces of the hosts. But just like Morning Joe did during the 2016 campaign, they bend all the rules when Trump decides to surface. So later in this conversation, Trump said, "I want a trial. A trial in the Senate." So one listener sent me some information speculating that Trump's secret visit to Walter Reed Military Hospital in Washington last week was to adjust his medications. That certainly could be true, although this is not indication of a stable genius acting in a stable manner. So he attacked David Holmes. And this is, just another case of Trump trying to create his own reality. Because we have a detailed witness statement from yesterday from David Holmes, the guy who was a diplomat at the embassy in Kiev. And Gordon Sondland has acknowledged the details of Holmes' testimony. And that was that Sondland decided at this lunch in Kiev to call Trump. Trump took the call. And Trump bellows into a speakerphone so loudly that David Holmes could hear what Trump was saying from across the lunch table. But Trump, and this is the kind of thing that he does so routinely, quote, "I guarantee you that never took place." He added that he barely knew Gordon Sondland, the wealthy hotelier from Portland, Oregon, who paid $1 million to the inaugural committee to buy his ambassadorship to the European Union. By his testimony, Sondland said, "Well, I talked to Trump about 20 times on the phone. And we had some good bad boy banter with a lot of four-letter words, colorful language," he said. But Trump barely knows the guy. Just like he, barely knows Michael Cohen these days, and on and on. Here's a quote. This guy Sondland, "Hardly know him. I've had a couple of conversations with him. I see him hanging around when I go to Europe." He appointed this guy. And now he wants to claim that, I barely know him, never heard of him. But he really was the European ambassador, he said, and all of a sudden he's working on this. Ask about that. Well, when you asked Gordon Sondland, when Fiona Hill asked Gordon Sondland, he said, "I'm operating on direct orders from the president." So denial and deniability are separate, but not in Trump's mind. One of the other kind of silly issues that has surfaced is that John Bolton claimed that the White House had made his personal Twitter account inaccessible. Now, I'm not quite sure how that would happen. Johnny Mustache should have the passwords, right? But Trump says that he didn't block or freeze Bolton's Twitter account. I don't know, like I say, how that would happen anyway. But Bolton tweeted today, "We have now liberated the Twitter account previously suppressed unfairly in the aftermath of my resignation." More to come. So one of the things that Trump, when he gets aggressive like this and counterpunches, it's his style. Even Melania has told us about it, right? And over at the Washington Post, a couple of reporters write, "Trump has always reached into his ready arsenal of aggressive tactics when he's up against the wall. Confronted with challenges that would make many people search for a way out, he punches back, insults those who speak against him, tosses up falsehoods and distracting stories he knows will get big play in the news media." Yeah, because you report it. "And offers frequently shifting alternative narratives." Now, I think that's all accurate. So today, even Republicans are scratching their heads at this, and the lead quote is from Peter King, the right-wing nut from Long Island who has announced he won't run for another term. It makes it more politically difficult for us," he said, "but it doesn't change how we'll vote on impeachment." So this mafia-like mob will support its leader because I guess they're afraid he'll tweet them to death. Here's another quote from King. "We Republicans are going to say, we're going to say about Fiona Hill and about Marie Yovanovitch. She's had an excellent career, but she wasn't there in the decisive moment, so thank you for your testifying. Have a nice day." Then Trump attacked her, and that set a tone. It makes it more uncomfortable for people. And Trump went after the former ambassador, Yovanovitch, again on his Fox News ramble, saying that she hated me so much, and falsely calling her an Obama person, while complaining that because she's a woman, you have to be nice. I guess that was nice. So it is a quandary for Republicans. But do not believe that, you know, this impeachment phase is behind us and there may be more. They may refer this to the Judiciary Committee. Maybe they'll tack on charges related to obstruction of justice out of the Mueller report. Maybe they will tack on the Michael Cohen crime. But Trump's not finished. And this episode on Fox E Friends is really just a warm-up. And we'll get to that in a moment. But first today, based on Fiona Hill's testimony, the New York Times tried to build more on her, number one, flat denial that there was any improper behavior by Ukrainians that might have been called meddling in 2016's American election, and two, her embrace of the Russiagate narrative as the truth, where the Ukraine angle is a fantasy. A fictional narrative, she called it. So the Times builds on this, and they say this demonstrates Russia's persistence in trying to sow discord among its adversaries, showing that the Kremlin apparently succeeded. And I take deep issue with this. I think this is a false narrative, a fictional narrative. And as I'll say in a moment, there are open questions about Ukraine, whether you believe Trump and his cult-like loyalists or not. So back to the Times story. The campaign by Russian intelligence in recent years has been even more complex as Moscow tries not only to undermine the government in Kyiv, but also to use a disinformation campaign there to influence the American political debate. Now, I don't deny that Russia is a very aggressive cyber warrior. I do not deny that they, frequently try to destabilize other governments. But can we get real? As I said yesterday, it's Americans who have been causing discord, dividing ourselves. And Trump is the leader of this Twitter mob. And you want to say that Russians have more influence and cause Americans to get confused and fight against each other? And the Times cites this woman, Elise Stefanik. She served in the Bush White House, and she surfaced as one of the attack dogs on the impeachment hearings this week. She and her Republican colleagues have also steered clear of what the Times calls the fringe notion that Trump mentioned to Zelensky, which is about the CrowdStrike server. And the Republicans also say that they believe Russia meddled, just that Trump didn't collude with them. Now, to the issue of whether Ukraine did any meddling in 2016, I turn to our friend, journalist Yasha Levine. Yasha was a Jewish Soviet emigre to the United States. He grew up in San Francisco. He has spent time in Russia as a reporter, and he's also spent time in Ukraine. And he says, I've written about this before, but I have to address it again. Meddling in the 2016 election by Ukrainian politicians and government agencies happened. The above is true, and no amount of denial is going to change that. What's more, Ukrainian nationals didn't just meddle on their own, they also worked with Americans, including Ukrainian-American political operatives on the payroll of the Democratic Party. Not only did all this happen, it was written up as fact by establishment papers and outlets from Yahoo, Politico, and the Financial Times in 2016. The involvement of Ukrainian pals and officials has never been secret. It was acknowledged at the time, and the principal actors openly admitted it. One of the best examples is the plot to take down Paul Manafort, the sleazy Republican political consultant who had long worked in Ukraine and was Trump's campaign manager. Previously, he had been richly rewarded for providing political campaign advice to Yanukovych. So, Levine continues, in 2016, Serhiy Leshenko, a Ukrainian member of parliament and an anti-corruption activist, coordinated the release of the Black Ledger. The document purported to show off-the-book payments made to Manafort from the Party of the Regions, that's Yanukovych's party. The ledger itself was released by a Ukrainian government anti-corruption organization set up as a result of prodding by the Obama administration, which was run with the backing and financial support of the FBI. Leshenko, a foreign politician, made clear that his objective at the time was to kill off Trump's candidacy. Leshenko hoped that the release of Manafort info would hurt Trump. Here's a comment he made. I think this is the last nail into Manafort's coffin, hopefully also that of Trump. Levine continues that Lev Galinkin explained in The Nation a few months ago that the release of that ledger by Leshenko was an important event. The story rocked the 2016 election, given Manafort's position as head of Trump's campaign. The Clinton campaign immediately seized upon it as proof that Manafort was tied to Yanukovych and the Kremlin. So, I encourage you to, I'll put up a link to Yasha's post. I just made a note to do that. And I again, keep an open mind here. And I think we have to be prepared for a massive counterattack by the Republicans. And it may come when the latest Inspector General report from Michael Horowitz is released from the Justice Department. And there have been apparently some leaks. And it's interesting because I did a Google search for FISA Court, FBI, and Horowitz. The only articles that came up are from right-wing outlets, Judicial Watch, The Daily Caller, and a number of others, Breitbart. There is no coverage of this in the corporate media that I surveyed today. So we don't have much detail on what Horowitz has been doing, but he is teasing us, saying the draft report is lengthy. It concerns sensitive national security and law enforcement matters. It is lightly redacted, he says, but they're finishing up the clearance of it. And so he is tipping that it's going to come shortly. I spent about 5 minutes listening to Rush Limbaugh on the way to the secret studio today, and he says that Horowitz has identified an FBI employee who altered documents that were submitted to the FISA court related to the Carter Page FISA warrant. Now, I'm very curious about this because I, you know, have been a sharp critic of the FISA court for over 25 years. We know Judge Reggie Walton, when he sat atop the FISA court, complained bitterly that he was lied to by the agencies that came asking for warrants. And so there are deep vulnerabilities here. The Russiagate narrative, as you know, I'm skeptical of. The media's embrace of it, using anonymous sources and leaked documents, makes them deeply vulnerable to a fake news attack from Trump. So I know there are a lot of people who are doing high fives and, you know, doing dances around their Adam Schiff doll on an altar in their homes. But friends, be careful. I have deep concerns that this is built on a very weak foundation and could collapse. So today I'm releasing an in-depth interview with two individuals. One is Professor Serhii Plokhii. He is a professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard University, and the basis of the interview was to talk about his new book, which we'll get to in a moment. But I could not resist asking a Ukrainian native who is an expert on Ukrainian history to comment on the events since 1990 or so when the Soviet Union broke up. And I was deeply disappointed that Professor Plokhii embraces what I consider to be the government line on U.S. meddling in Ukraine. I invite you to listen to the interview. We spent about 20 minutes talking about current events, and then we shifted to his book, which I'll talk about in a moment. But listen to this excerpt from the interview as the professor responds to my questions about how we, the West, including Russia at the time, made an agreement with Ukraine where we offered what the professor calls assurances but not guarantees. The U.S. and Russia both gave assurances that Ukraine would be defended when it gave up its nuclear weapons as part of the deal that was codified in 1994. The professor called Obama's response to the Russian grab of Crimea as measured, and that's a very diplomatic term of criticism, but way too diplomatic for me. And then when I asked if the Maidan Revolution was a U.S.-backed coup, the professor said, well, you know, I know Victoria Nuland gave some cookies out, but I don't buy that it was a U.S. plot. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Professor Plokhii.
The only evidence to support them that I found so far was the fact that Victoria Nuland, then of the State Department, was handing the cookies to the people on Maidan. So I don't buy the plot, CIA-backed or European-backed plots at all. So what happened there was that the Yanukovych government, for 1 year before the protest started, was really promising and raising expectations when it comes to the Ukrainian society that Ukraine would sign association agreement with the European Union. So it was 1 year long propaganda. And then under pressure from Russia, Mr. Yanukovych goes to a European Union summit in Vilnius and says that he was not going to sign the agreement. And that's what brought people on the streets. And then in Ukrainian fashion or manner, like it was before that in the year 2004, they just refused to leave the streets. So it was going one day after another. The protests were not huge. But then the police was used, and they were beating up students. And that's what brought really masses to the streets. So some of these manifestations or demonstrations, the number of people on the streets were 800, even more. So I certainly treat very, very seriously CIA and other intelligence services. But I don't think they're capable of doing things like that. Being so many people on the streets in the sub-zero temperatures, and those people actually then would refuse to leave.
That's Professor Serhii Plokhii of Harvard. And as you heard, He has very firm views, and I don't agree with them, but I do respect the professor. And his new book I found very interesting. It's called The Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front, and he takes us back to 1944 at the height of World War II, the only time that U.S. and Soviets fought side by side. And in his book, he says that when this episode ended, with rivalries between the U.S. and Russia, it essentially formed the origins of the Cold War.
Well, it was a truly, truly unique story and part of World War II, because we certainly know a lot, or at least heard about, the Grand Alliance. And that's the United States, Soviet Union, and Britain fighting together, Nazi Germany. Well, there was one particular feature of that alliance, that the U.S. and Britain were fighting side by side, but the Soviets were fighting their own war on their own front, which was Eastern Front. There was just one episode when the Americans and the Soviets were fighting together side by side against the Germans, and that happened in 44-45 in Poltava area in Ukraine.
That's Harvard Professor Plohy talking about his book, Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front, and taking us back to 1944. In the second part of today's in-depth interview podcast, we talked to Rich Cahan. He is a former photo editor of the Chicago Sun-Times, and his latest book is a powerful collection of photographs that were taken by U.S. Army photographers during the final year of World War II. And what I find powerful about this book is that it really has an anti-war theme, describing the real toll of the worldwide conflict back in the 1940s. Here's Rich Cahan.
Certainly a book about World War II, and it really focuses on the year 1945, but it's not a usual war book. It's more of an anti-war book. It's more of a look at the effect of war, and that's why we called it Aftershock, because it's not just an aftermath. The toll of war is so extensive and so brutal that we really looked at those photos.
That's Rich Cahan, and I commend his new book to you. You can hear the full interview with both Cahan and Professor Plohy. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, and Stitcher. And all this is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions. And I want to mention Brian Mazzi, Andrew Rush, Suzanne Bowen, and Aidan McAleer. They each chip in $5 or $10 a month to help keep this podcast going. Could you help out, too? Well, if you answer yes, visit peterbcollins.com, will you, and take care of business. I'm pleased to have some new subscribers signing up recently, and I'd like to keep that momentum going. So, peterbcollins.com, click menu, click become a subscriber. You hit the sign-up page, and it's easy for you to take it from there. A few minutes ago, I mentioned, about Russian meddling, Ukrainian meddling, and how Fiona Hill says that Russians, used Facebook and disinformation to manipulate American voters. Well, here is Exhibit A about why I remain skeptical. This is published in today's New York Times under the byline of San Francisco reporter Nicole Perlroth. And she discloses that there is a guy who used to be an executive of Fox News named Ken LaCourte. And LaCourte operates two different websites, one for the left and one for the right. These are pandering websites designed to generate clicks. On the left, it's the Liberal Edition News. On the right, it's the Conservative Edition News. And all of this feeds into another site that he has. The content is written by underpaid people in Macedonia. And LaCourte's goal is to stoke passions on both sides of the political aisle and cash in on that anger. Now, there are no bylines there. The ownership of the website is described only as Bivona Digital Incorporated, and they give a Dropbox address here in Sausalito. LaCourte says, I wanted to try to find middle ground. Unfortunately, the things that work best right now are hyperactive politics. On one hand, that's at odds with what I want to do. But you can be more successful by playing the edgy clickbait game. Let me remind you again, friends, that one of the most reported viral attacks during the 2016 campaign, the false claim that Pope Francis had endorsed Trump, was generated by an American who had just graduated from college and didn't have a job. And when I hear all this talk about the Russians dividing Americans, maybe they amplify things. But we do this to ourselves first and foremost. So as we look around the globe right now, there are protests and violent crackdowns by governments almost all around the world. In Iran, the authorities say that the protests are over. But based on hospital admissions and just observation of the streets, the protests over gas prices continue. Angry citizens are on the streets of Colombia. Three protesters died in clashes with security forces in Iraq yesterday. The turmoil continues in Beirut, and that's just scratching the surface. In today's New York Times, David Brooks, not my favorite opinion columnist, but I've interviewed him a couple of times, and he is a gentleman. He writes, "Have you noticed that the world is on fire? Crowds are chanting, 'Death to Khomeini,' in Iran. Throngs are marching to preserve democratic rights in Hong Kong, Warsaw, Budapest, Istanbul, and Moscow. The masses are angry in Pakistan, Indonesia, and Saudi Arabia, toppling leaders in Lebanon and Bolivia." Now, I do not accept the Bolivian story. I do believe that that is a U.S.-backed coup. And also, when he writes about Venezuela, he shows his corporate leanings. But he writes, "The seeds of today's unrest were planted in the events of 30 years ago, the fall of the Soviet Union, the spread of globalization, and all the rest. That was the heyday of liberal democratic capitalism, free market fundamentalism, the end of history," he said. And so he describes the core problem as economic. The second thing is corruption. And the third is freedom. And what's interesting is the nation that has severe problems is the one that has the quietest streets, it appears, right now. And that would be the good old U.S. of A. So Barack Obama is back at it. He is out courting mega donors to fund the Democratic National Committee, which is underfunded once again. And he was here in the Bay Area. He went to Los Altos Hills, one of the most upscale communities here in, and that one's in Silicon Valley. And at a fundraiser, he gave these conflicting comments. He said, "If I were running today, I wouldn't run the same campaign I ran in 2008. I want candidates now to propose policies beyond what we were able to get done because the politics have changed. It's very important for the Democratic Party to be clear and bold about saying that we are going to take on some of those structural changes, or we're going to initiate structural changes that reduce that inequality." So he is finally addressing income and wealth inequality in this country. This is the guy who presided over the roll-up of the Occupy movement, which was an organic effort during his administration to draw attention to these very issues. And then, in a fanciful comment, Obama encouraged labor unions to rethink how they organize and work with innovative companies who recognize that shareholder value and quarterly earnings are not the only thing that is important. Well, these companies are virulently anti-union, Barry. Haven't you noticed? You failed to honor your commitments to organized labor as you were president. And then the guy who, as the first African-American president, played down his race and was mostly missing in action from Ferguson, Baltimore, any racial incident you can summon. And he says, rather than attacking racists, he said, "You know, there's a way to talk about it that says we can do better." Now, I don't know where he's been since he left the White House. He's a smart guy. I'm sure he reads a lot and knows a lot, talks to a lot of people. But you can't respond to the virulent racism coming from Trump and his ilk with, "Hey, you know, we can do better." I think Obama needs to take a vow of silence, at least through November of 2020. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders is showing some polling strength. He has moved up in the, here's the KKF tracking poll. He is now topping the Democratic field, and in some of the matchups, he beats Trump better than Biden does. Bernie is now tied for first, having gained 7 points in Emerson's national poll. He's tied for first in the most recent survey there. He is now back in second, having picked up 5 points in the Real Clear Politics polling average. So I consider that to be encouraging. And this is too. Melissa Batchelor Warnke describes herself as a college professor who was a big Hillary Clinton supporter in 2016. She explains that Clinton seemed more electable, she wanted a woman, and add to that Sanders' refusal to cede the race for so long, divisive, I thought, and the patronizing, vicious manner of some of his supporters. I get their frustration now, sort of, as my own politics have moved to the left these last 4 years. But I also learned how hard it is for people to internalize what you're saying when you're yelling at them. And she says that it was a beloved Bernie supporter who took the time to talk it through with her that opened her mind. She said, once I started hearing Sanders, he was everywhere. A piece he wrote integrating his own history into his views on anti-Semitism, Israel, and Palestine moved me, all the more so for striking a balance so hard to land. A little bit later, she writes, Sanders talks about what we could do, what he imagines for us, and he extends that us beyond his voters to the undocumented, to those who've been lost in a DACA loophole. Sure, you could see these gestures as angling for the Latinx vote, but he doesn't really angle. He says he's going to tax people. He says he's going to overhaul health care immediately and completely. He's mad like all the time. He is truly not here to make friends. And I don't see this kind of purpose too many other places on the Democratic debate stage. She says maybe Elizabeth Warren. Then she went to cover a Joe Biden rally in downtown Los Angeles last week that fewer than 100 people showed up for. And she invited her students to try to find a college-age Biden supporter, and they couldn't. So I commend this piece to you. I think it's pretty interesting. Also, I suggest you read a piece by Kevin Gostola as he takes on the attacks on Tulsi Gabbard since her debate performance this week. And on my Facebook newsfeed, I am appalled at the people who just dismiss Gabbard as a Russian plant. I mean, they buy Hillary's line, and they dismiss her as not a Democrat because she calls out the obvious failings of the Democratic Party. And I think that Gostola's done a good job here. No time to quote from it, but take a look. The link is in the show file for today's podcast. So Google has announced its revised political advertising rules. And one of the things they're doing is saying that they will not allow political campaigns to micro-target voters. Now, Google collects all this data, and that's why people use it to run ad campaigns. Because you can identify that a certain person at a certain IP address reads left-wing posts on Facebook or, searches for left-wing topics on Google. So I actually think that's a mistake. And critics are saying that the new policy also doesn't do anything to limit disinformation. And I didn't know about this, but they point out that a quick search on YouTube under the name Senator Kamala Harris turns up dozens of videos that are spreading the lie that Kamala Harris is not an American citizen. Some of them have views of more than 100,000, and none of these videos are ads, so they're not affected by this policy change. I'm not a fan of Kamala Harris, but I will stipulate right here and right now, she was born in either Oakland or Berkeley, right here in the Bay Area, and she is, in fact, an American citizen. Workers, take it on the chin. I've got two stories under this file today. In Portland, Oregon, a jury has delivered a huge setback that could be fatal to the international, ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. These are the dock workers. And this is related to a job action back in 2012 in Portland. And the company sued, and a jury has awarded $93.6 million and told the ILWU to pay it. They have $8 million in assets. As I say, that could be fatal unless the judge reduces the award. And I didn't know about this, but back in September, tens of thousands of Americans had their paycheck directly deposited in their account. And then within a day or two, the money had been retrieved. This is the result of a massive fraud. And the accused fraudster is Michael Mann, the president of My Payroll HR. He apparently fleeced $26 million in one payroll period and funneled it into his own personal accounts. This set off a cascade of events, and companies like My Payroll HR, who had deposited the payments into people's accounts, had to take them back because they didn't have the money to cover. This exposes the vulnerability of the automated clearinghouse network that moved 23 billion electronic payments last year. So Mann was arrested on September 10th and charged with fraud, and he has admitted to stealing at least $70 million in this manner. While we're in the courts, here's a doozy. A longtime CIA case officer accused of spying for China was sentenced to 19 years in prison today, even though there is no evidence that he gave classified information to the Chinese. All they have is records that he has $840,000 that he refuses to explain, you know, where it came from. And so in court, they were apparently able to persuade a jury or a judge, it's not clear what kind of trial it was, that because he had the money, he must have coughed up something in exchange. But this guy worked for the CIA. And did I give you his name? It's Jerry Chun Xing Li, aged 55. So he worked for the CIA, and then he quit because he became an entrepreneur. And he owned a company, a tobacco company. So in 2010, he started his own tobacco company. And then an old CIA colleague asked him to come back to the agency. And it was when he reapplied, in his interviews, they say that he lied about getting instructions from the Chinese and keeping notes that included classified information. Don't they have to prove the crime? Apparently not. A federal judge today has also ordered the government of Iran to pay the Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian $180 million in damages for his 18-month detention starting in 2014. Now, he was on duty for the Washington Post in Tehran, and his wife was a journalist for another outlet, not American. They were newlywed. Both of them were arrested. She was detained for 2 months. He was held for 18 months and finally released. I don't think they'll ever see a dime of that, but I'm happy for the Rezaian family. Here's another doozy. The Supreme Court in Indiana has taken a case and heard oral arguments about a man named Derek Huring from Boonville, Indiana, who was charged with theft because he removed a GPS tracking device that cops had put on his Ford Expedition. So after the device stopped delivering electronic signals to the cops, they went to his house. They found that he had hidden it in a barn on his property. And nearby, they found a glass pipe, and they later found drugs, meth, digital scales, and a gun. But I believe that the Indiana Supreme Court is going to have to operate under the precedent of the U.S. Supreme Court which in a rare ruling that protects our Fourth Amendment rights, said that the cops cannot secretly put a GPS tracker on your car. And so, if that's the case, how could it be a crime to remove it? And finally, today I want to take a swipe at some arrogant, petty, and tone-deaf officials here in San Francisco. As you know, we had a remarkable election where a way progressive guy, a former public defender named Chesa Boudin, was elected our district attorney. And he replaced a guy named George Gascon. Gascon had been the police chief in San Francisco, and when now Governor Gavin Newsom went to Sacramento as lieutenant governor, he engineered this backroom deal where Gascon flipped from police chief to district attorney. And then Gascon surprised us all by being one of the most progressive district attorneys in recent San Francisco history. But he upset London Breed, the corporate-backed mayor of San Francisco. She was handily elected in November. No opposition. But Breed and Dennis Herrera, the city attorney, are now endorsing the sitting district attorney, the incumbent in Los Angeles, whose name is Jackie Lacey. And she's a pretty hard on, you know, tough on crime, lock 'em up kind of DA. And George Gascon, who used to live in Los Angeles, he has moved back to L.A. and filed papers to challenge Lacey for the district attorney job. The mayor of San Francisco has no business meddling in the politics of the city of Los Angeles. But the campaign that attacked Chesa Boudin included nasty, misleading ads paid for by the San Francisco Police Officers Association with substantial funding provided by the Los Angeles Peace Officers Association. It's stinky. From here all the way to L.A. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I am Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.